tonight, the Boston bomber speaks, his apology to the survivors he maimed and the families of the people he murdered. Tonight, what they said back, including the father of the youngest victim, as a judge condemns his killer to death. Heartbreak in South Carolina, as a beloved pastor is honored at the state capitol, a sea of mourners in the shadow of that polarizing flag. It's called The Silent Killer, taking the lives of Patrick Swayze, Michael Landon, and so many more. By the time it's found, it's usually too late. Tonight, there's new hope in detecting pancreatic cancer. And Sleepless in America, millions tossing and turning and surfing in bed. We'll show you what staring at those screens is doing to your brain, why they're keeping you from a good night's sleep. Nightly News begins right now.
From NBC News World Headquarters in New York, this is NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt.
Good evening. We begin with an apology today from the Boston Marathon bomber, Zohar Tsarnaev, breaking his silence more than 2 years after the attack that killed three people and injured more than 260. I am sorry for the lives that I've taken, he told a courtroom filled with survivors and families of victims. His words, however, too little too late for the judge who, following a jury's verdict, formally sentenced the 21-year-old to death. Pete Williams has covered the story since that awful April day in 2013 and was inside the courtroom today for the trial's emotional end.
Some of those most affected by the marathon bombings came to court for an opportunity they'd waited 2 years for, telling Zohar Tsarnaev the pain he caused. Bill Richard, the father of 8-year-old Martin, the youngest to die in the bombing, stood with his wife Denise as Tsarnaev sat 20 feet away. Richard said Tsarnaev could have stopped his older brother Tamerlan, who planned the bombings. He chose to do nothing, said Richard. He chose hate, destruction, and death. Heather Abbott, who lost a leg after the bombing, said the jury had a hard time deciding between life and death. I can't understand, she said, how he made the decision about who would live and who would die. One of the most forceful statements came from Rebecca Gregory, who also lost a leg from the bombing. I'm not somebody's victim, she told Tsarnaev. Not yours, not your brother's. Referring to the video shown in court of his gesture to a surveillance camera, she said, that is so funny that you smirk. That's what we do to you every day. The response to the bombing, she said, unified the city and the nation and brought out the best in people. We are Boston strong and America strong, she said. Choosing to mess with us was a terrible idea. How's that for a victim impact statement? Finally, Tsarnaev himself stood, choking up, when he said, I am sorry for the lives I have taken, adding, I'd like to now apologize to the victims, to the survivors. He asked for Allah's mercy. Many survivors said it was too late.
I regret having ever wanted to hear him speak because what he said showed no remorse, no regret, and no empathy for what he's done to our lives.
And at no point during his statement did he renounce the reasons for which he committed this act. He never renounced terrorism. He did not repudiate violent extremism.
But Liz Norton, whose two sons each lost a leg, said it was helpful.
I really feel like a weight has been lifted off our shoulders, and I honestly can say my sons will probably be happy that I found out what I needed to find, and I think we can really close a chapter.
Pete Williams, you've spent a lot of time in that courtroom. You were there for the days of gut-wrenching testimony, of horrible, graphic pieces of evidence. What was the difference? What was it like to hear him speak in that courtroom?
Well, today, Lester, what struck me is that most of those who spoke were not people who had lost limbs or loved ones. They suffer from post-traumatic stress. They have panic attacks and flashbacks. They're in constant pain. They can't sleep. They have trouble holding a job. They don't want to go out in crowds. It was a reminder that hundreds of people with no visible injuries still had their lives shattered. Now, as for Tsarnaev, he's off to a federal prison while years of legal appeals now begin.
All right. Pete Williams in Boston tonight. Thank you. We're learning that federal hate crime charges will likely be filed against Dylan Roof. He's the man accused of carrying out the racially motivated massacre at a historic black church in Charleston a week ago. The feds are considering bringing charges to back up South Carolina's prosecution. That state does not have its own hate crime law. Meantime, the people of Charleston have begun formally paying their last respects to the 9 victims of that massacre. A moving memorial today at the South Carolina State House, taking place just yards from the Confederate flag that has provoked so much controversy in the wake of this tragedy. Ron Ellen continues to lead our coverage from there.
Today, a very solemn public tribute to a Native son whose death, along with his fellow worshipers, has South Carolina searching its soul. As the Reverend Clemente Pinckney's body arrived at the Capitol, passing under the Confederate flag. The late state senator then lying in a place of honor in the Capitol Rotunda. A black drape blocking the view of the flag outside, but not the anger.
Yeah, the flag. It's time for it to come down. We need to put an end to it.
The line of mourners under a blazing sun stretched around the Capitol.
He fought in the Lord's army. He fought in the political army. And to see this end this way because of hatred, it hurts.
While the Capitol's flag flew, the state's prestigious military academy, the Citadel, removed the Confederate naval jack from its main chapel, as more prominent leaders said they could no longer defend the rebel banner. State Senator Paul Thurmond is a son of the legendary segregationist, Senator and Governor Strom Thurmond.
I am proud to be on the right side of history regarding the removal of this symbol of racism and bigotry.
Today, Alabama's governor ordered the Confederate battle flag and four other banners removed from the Capitol grounds. And Virginia's governor has recalled license plates bearing the image, some 2,000 of them. Jeff O'Kane of the Sons of Confederate Veterans says he worries this won't stop at the flag.
Then it will be this statue, that statue. We're on a slippery slope here. You're going to try to eradicate history so it doesn't offend anybody. It already happened. We can't change history.
And this evening, friends and relatives are paying their last respects to Ethel Lance, 70, a retired mother and grandmother, and for 30 years a custodian at Mother Emanuel, where she died. Reverend Pinckney will be laid to rest on Friday with President Obama here to deliver the eulogy.
Ron Allen from Columbia tonight, thanks. A stunning reveal from the White House today that over 30 Americans are being held hostage abroad. We've never heard that particular number. That information coming out as President Obama announced a major change to the U.S. policy on families paying out ransom in the hopes of bringing their captive loved ones back home. We get the details from our national correspondent, Peter Alexander.
Today's policy shift could give new hope to Caitlin Coleman of Pennsylvania, kidnapped by the Taliban in Afghanistan. She's one of more than 30 Americans being held hostage overseas. This afternoon, a contrite President Obama conceded the U.S. government at times has failed the families of hostages held by terrorists.
These families have already suffered enough, and they should never feel ignored or victimized by their own government.
Today, he vowed to do better.
We're not going to abandon you. We will stand by you.
While the president insisted the U.S. will not make concessions, including paying ransom, the U.S. is willing to communicate with terrorist groups, and families won't face prosecution if they want to pay in hopes of freeing their loved ones.
Doesn't that ultimately put a price tag on Americans' heads overseas?
There's no doubt that the payment of ransoms fuels the very activity that we are trying to stop.
Critics on Capitol Hill argue it'll put more American lives at risk.
If you reward hostage-taking behavior, you're going to get more hostage-taking.
The family of journalist James Foley, killed by ISIS last summer, applauded today's announcement, calling it an awakening to make kidnapped Americans a true priority. Before they killed him, Foley's captors were demanding more than $5 million ransom. And today, Foley's former boss expressed concerns the new policy puts a burden squarely on families.
That is a great deal of money for any average person, or maybe any person, to raise.
And earlier today, the president met privately with the families of former and current hostages. He said it was an emotional meeting. Tonight, one family who was there reacted to the policy changes, and while nothing, of course, will bring their son back, they said his death made a difference. Lester?
Peter Alexander, thank you. Tonight, 29 million people in 12 states are at risk for severe storms, a dangerous system bringing the threat of even more tornadoes, strong winds, flash floods, and hail. Some areas in the danger zone are still reeling from storms this week. The Weather Channel's Mike Seidel is in hard-hit Coal City, Illinois.
Violent weather swept across the country, leaving more than 800,000 without power. 70-mile-per-hour wind gusts from Ohio to Maine splintered and uprooted trees.
So I felt the gust of wind. I noticed the trees starting to pick up, and then all of a sudden, ba-boom.
A tornado touched down near Boston. And after the storm, a kaleidoscope sky over Fenway. And a scare for those at Nationals Park in Washington as lightning hit a crane. In Sheffield, Pennsylvania, 15-year-old Alexis Turner was killed while camping in the Allegheny National Forest with 25 other teens and counselors.
And there's a number of trees down and came within, fell right into their campsite.
Three others were hurt. In New Jersey, just across the bridge from Philadelphia, a possible tornado flipped cars at this mall parking lot.
It sounded like a freight train was coming down the road.
It was scary. The rain just came in.
Tonight, much of the Midwest, including Chicago, is bracing for more severe storms after getting slammed by at least 17 tornadoes the past 2 days. Coal City, Illinois, took a direct hit from an EF3 twister.
Most of the stuff is beyond salvageable. It's already damaged from the rain last night.
Many there scrambling for shelter, dreading the thought they could be hit again. Late word this afternoon, a lightning strike injured 5 construction workers in Colorado Springs. The biggest threat tonight for severe weather and tornadoes in parts of Iowa and Illinois. Tomorrow, look at that threat zone. Nearly 50 million stretching from D.C. all the way to St. Louis. And back here in Coal City tonight, the cleanup continues. As they watch the skies, Lester, as they darken now to the west, more storms on the way in.
All right, Mike Seidel from the Weather Channel. Thank you. Authorities in upstate New York said today the search area for those two escaped killers is now 75 square miles. It's an area just larger than Washington, D.C. The hunter who surprised Richard, Matt, and David Sweat at a remote cabin on Saturday gave the authorities their best chance yet of capturing them, but the two killers may have slipped through the dragnet around the cabin. Tonight, there are now 13 Republican candidates officially running for president as Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal jumped into the race for the nomination today. The conservative lawmaker released one of the more unique announcement videos in recent years, showing Jindal and his wife speaking to their 3 young children about their decision. There is new hope tonight in the battle against one of the deadliest forms of cancer. Nearly 49,000 people are diagnosed with pancreatic cancer every year in this country. Often by the time it's caught, it's too late because there's really no way currently to detect it early. But today, we got word of a new test that could change that in the future. NBC's Ann Thompson has more on that.
Actor Patrick Swayze, Michael Landon, opera singer Luciano Pavarotti. These are some of the high-profile faces of pancreatic cancer. Most patients die within the first year of diagnosis. 5-year survival is just 7%. Today, a study in the journal Nature says a blood test may be the answer to identifying this disease in its early stages. The test looks for a single molecule, a protein produced by cancer cells, that researchers say is a potential biomarker for pancreatic cancer.
They found that normal people don't have it. People with pancreas cancer do have it in high levels.
The test could be used to screen people with high risk factors, including a family history of pancreatic cancer, smoking and pancreatitis, and symptoms such as stomach pain, jaundice, and loss of appetite.
Is this blood test ready for general use?
This blood test is not ready for general use. It's a very promising biomarker that needs further study.
There's enthusiasm tonight to do more studies on this test for a disease that kills 40,000 Americans a year. Ann Thompson, NBC News, New York.
There's a lot more to tell you about here tonight. Still ahead, sleepless in America, the habit so many Americans just can't seem to break. Phones and tablets in bed, those glowing screens keeping us up all night. What doctors say you should do if you just can't turn them off. And later, a little boy with big moves and a big fan base, even though he can't hear them, cheering on him. How he and his teammates developed a winning game plan, coming up. Tonight, we begin a special series we're calling Sleepless in America, and here's an eye-opener. The CDC has called lack of sleep a public health epidemic, and most sleep experts say all our digital devices we're taking into the bedroom are taking a toll on getting a good night's rest. NBC's Hallie Jackson now on Kicking the Habit.
At 10 p.m., bedtime's just beginning for Danny Fulton. Tonight, like every night, he turns to his tablet, then his phone, some TV, and the phone again.
You watch 1 a.m. go, and then 2 a.m. go, and then 3 a.m.
Scrolling and squirming.
I reach for the phone. That can start with a simple work email or a Skype message, and it may end with YouTube videos or a Wikipedia page. You just never know.
After just 4 hours of sleep, Danny's up again for good.
Ended up dozing off about 3 a.m.
He heads to work, functioning, but barely.
I'm addicted to the device at some points.
Why not put it in a drawer or in another room when you go to bed?
I can't break free from it.
Experts say it's no coincidence 95% of us look at some kind of screen within an hour of bedtime, and 85% have trouble falling asleep.
With all the devices that we carry around, hold right next to our face and check our emails or watch movies or whatever, it is delaying what our brain interprets as sunset.
The blue light from those screens send a signal it's still daylight, triggering a surge of energy and blocking the melatonin that makes us sleepy. No wonder, then, that with the device on nearly every nightstand, one in three people sleeps less than 6 hours a day, raising the risk for diabetes, heart disease, obesity, and depression. Danny knows the risks after a lifetime of struggling to sleep.
I know that long term is going to have, it has the potential for grave consequences. It's shortening my life.
The solution seems obvious. Get more sleep. But how?
Get the electronics out of the bedroom. The bedroom should be reserved for sleep and sex. That's about it.
Doctors recommend shutting off all your screens an hour before bed. But if that feels impossible, at least use an app to flip the background so it's black with white letters. That'll have less of an effect on your system. And start good habits early.
Meanwhile, boo.
Like the Stevensons. 11-year-old Raphael can only use his phone and play video games downstairs.
We made this a complete electronic-free zone.
The bedroom is for books only.
It really helps me a lot.
It works for kids and adults, so don't just dream of disconnecting. Better sleep for most of us is just a click away. Hallie Jackson, NBC News, Lexington, Kentucky.
Tomorrow night, we're going to look at so-called sleep divorce. This is happily married couples forced to sleep in separate rooms. Coming up here next tonight, late word from the family of Whitney Houston about the condition of her daughter, Bobby Christina. A developing situation we're monitoring in Southern California right now, a brush fire burning next to the I-5 freeway near Santa Clarita. Smoke billowing into the air, hundreds of firefighters on the ground, in the air as well, working to put it out before it gets too close to homes. Tonight, after months in the hospital, Whitney Houston's daughter, Bobby Christina Brown, has been moved to hospice care. Her aunt, Pat Houston, says she's in God's hands now, revealing her condition has continued to deteriorate since she was found unresponsive in a bathtub in January, similar to the way her mother died 3 years ago. When we come back, the 8-year-old who won't let anything hold him back from achieving his hoop dreams. Finally tonight, we want you to meet a young basketball player with his sights set on the NBA. He's taking on a challenge that sets him apart from most, but with the help of his team and a dedicated dad, he's out to prove he can accomplish anything. NBC's Jenna Wolf spent some time with him.
There's one thing everyone knows about Zeke Ortiz. He loves basketball, from shooting hoops in his backyard to competing with the Maryland Playmakers. But for this 8-year-old, the palpable excitement of the game is experienced like this. Zeke and his brother and parents and much of his extended family are deaf. His aunt, who can hear, interpreted for us.
What do you want to be when you grow up, Zeke?
A pro basketball player.
Earlier this year, this little kid made a big decision. He left his deaf team to join a more competitive league where he's the only deaf player.
At the very first practice, Zeke kept looking at us saying, I don't understand. And we said, it's okay. Just watch. Just try to figure out.
Having spent most of his life among deaf people, for the first time, he felt lost.
Everybody was talking, and I didn't know what they were saying or what to do.
So his dad started coming to every practice, giving up the stands for the sidelines.
I watched what was going on. I knew what the practice plays were. I would essentially interpret that for Zeke.
The coaches got creative, drawing plays on boards and using gestures to communicate. As the players got to know Zeke, the dynamic on the court started to change.
They'll use their own little sign language, but somehow they know how to communicate amongst each other.
I like point at him, then I point at the shooter.
And how you say, like, okay, there's a timeout, come over here.
On the day we joined Zeke at practice, I put his fearless shooting style to the test in a game of horse. Refusing to take it easy on someone far shorter than I am, I offered up this. Only to be schooled with this. This team of 10 has come a long way together.
Is he a good basketball player?
Yes.
With the help of his team, this new kid, who at first struggled to find his place, is now exactly where he belongs. Jenna Wolf, NBC News, Frederick, Maryland.
And good luck to Zeke and his team in the national championship this weekend. Go get them, guys. That's going to do it for us on a Wednesday night. I'm Lester Holt. Thanks for watching and have a good night, everyone.